G'day folks, welcome to Stick With It, APA's podcast for its pilots.
Today I'm joined by three members of COM who were part of APA's delegation to the recent 77th IFALPA conference in Montreal. We have Captain Tony Lucas, President of APA, Captain Shane Loney, who is one of APA's FSAG reps and a previous Director of the Safety and Technical Portfolio, and First Officer Steve Cornell, APA's current Safety and Technical Director. Welcome, gents. Now, to Tony first. Tony, can you just sort of give us a bit of an overall vibe of what the event was like and some of the objectives that are occurring at that annual conference, and even just some information about how many delegates attend from the different unions?
Yeah, look, it was an interesting vibe, I thought. It was my first IFALPA conference for a variety of reasons. I didn't get to the IFALPA conference last year in Singapore, so this was my first time at the conference. I found it an interesting experience. Certainly very collegiate amongst all the MAs, member associations is the terminology. Lots of new jargon, as you would expect for an aviation forum. But yeah, a really positive experience. There was about, IFALPA is made up of about 75-ish member associations. There was about 50 in attendance and the rest were kind of proxies. Some of the MAs have got pilots of multiple airlines. For example, ALPA International is made up of North American and Canadian pilots from about 30-odd different airlines. And they've got a combined membership of 65,000. So, you know, for between the AFAP and APA, which makes up AusALPA, with our sort of 4,500 members, we're kind of one of the minnows at this sort of conference. But it's interesting, you know, the issues that we're kind of all dealing with are all the same. From across the board, it's quite amazing talking to pilots from Europe, Africa, the USA. We're all dealing with the same sorts of issues, some of which we'll probably cover off here shortly. But yeah, really, really positive experience and worthwhile.
Good to hear. Now, Shane, I know you've attended many of these conferences. Can you explain to us, I guess, what some of the tangible benefits are for our members with regard to APA's delegation attending? And also, I guess I'm interested in maybe, you know, those relationships, how that's actually benefited some of our members over the years.
Yeah, Mark, and you are right. I have attended a few of these. You've no idea of the joy of travelling hours and hours to get there to then sit up all day long when the body is screaming at you that it wants to be asleep. But we're pilots. We know what that feels like.
It's a glamorous life.
Yeah, it is a very, very valuable experience for mine. We learn a lot because in safety, there isn't much that happens in Australia that isn't also happening in other parts of the world. So we learn from them and they learn from us. The conferences are safety related primarily, and it's usually all around significant current issues. One of the big ones for this conference, and Steve will talk about it more later, and that's what's called RCO, Reduced Crew Operations. Big issue. We learn from those discussions and how we might go about making change in the overall aviation environment. For us at APA, we're always involved in these conversations. We hear what's happened in other parts of the world. Sometimes that causes us to look at our own procedures. Now, what are the issues that we're dealing with? How are we as an organisation managing those to make sure that we can best represent our members? I'll give you one example of that. At APA, we have an emergency response plan. Now, we've had one of those for a while, but we tweaked it a few years ago based on conversations out of IFALPA. What that means is we have a crew somewhere around the world. We've got procedures in place to how we might manage that with the resources available to APA, whether that's in the middle of the night or during the day. How do we gather our team to get the best results for those people on the ground? And one of the things that will definitely be important there is the relationship that we have with those member associations in that country. We can call on people. We might know them personally. If we don't know them personally, we will know that their organisation exists, that they're available to assist. And that might be a phone call to say, you know, one of our pilots has found themselves in a hospital or maybe, heaven forbid, in a jail somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, but we can get people on the ground in that area to go and assist their pilots. And we have had to call on that. So those are some really significant, tangible benefits from being part of IFALPA. Also, we need to remember that IFALPA is a really important player in world aviation. They're a permanent observer member at ICAO. So the things that we as pilots find that are wrong, sometimes right, with aviation, but if we want to drive change, we can do that. Might start in Australia. We raise those issues with the numerous bodies inside IFALPA, but then we have this connection through to ICAO where you have a chance of actually affecting real change, not just in Australia, but across the globe. So, yeah, there's no doubt to me there are many, many significant advantages for us. As I said, not much fun sitting through those days' events at times, and the networking rarely stops, but there is a lot for our members in attendance.
Now, Steve, I understand that there was a significant presentation on reduced crew operations. Can you sort of explain to us what was discussed and the implications for us closer to home?
Yeah, thanks, Hoff. So the IFALPA conference was preceded by the 12th Global Pilots Symposium. And the subject for this year was something that's fairly topical. It's been in the press a lot lately. And that is this push to reduce the number of pilots on the flight deck. So ALPA, the Airline Pilots Association, the European Cockpit Association, and IFALPA, they've come together to ensure the current standards that have contributed to making, you know, air transport one of the safest, if they're not the safest, mode of transportation, aren't eroded. They launched a campaign on that day. That campaign is called Safety Starts With Two. Now you can Google that and it will bring up with the website. You know, to summarize, the position is that two fully qualified, highly trained and well-rested pilots are an airliner's greatest safety asset. During that symposium and also throughout the IFALPA conference, there were some presentations on the technology that's being developed that would be, I guess, enabling this move. It seems to be largely being pushed by Airbus. Now, obviously, Airbus is owned by a group of European governments, and it's no surprise, I guess, it's being backed in by EASA, who are the European safety regulator. Yeah, some of those technologies, weather, sense and avoid, ATC voice recognition, incapacitation detection. At the moment, Airbus are pushing these technologies, or I guess pushing the benefits of them, in a two crew context, but it's fairly obvious to everybody who was at the symposium that the real goal is to move towards reduced crew operations.
And I understand you mentioned to me, I'm happy to talk about this, that the Boeing pilot spoke after the Airbus pilot. And does Boeing tend to share the same philosophy that Airbus do, from what you could see?
On the face of it, I would say no. So the Airbus test pilot did give a presentation. Interestingly, he didn't want to take questions on RCO after that presentation. He was then followed by the Boeing chief test pilot. And he stated that they are looking at building a new aircraft at the moment. And he emphasised that aircraft would have two seats, which did receive a rather large round of applause. I think Boeing's approach to automation has always been slightly different to Airbus, in that Boeing centres the pilot in that picture and the automation is there as a supporting tool. Mm-hmm. And Airbus seems to be taking the approach of using automation to reduce the crews, not centering the pilots in that process.
Thanks for that, Steve. So, Tony, clearly the single pilot threat is growing larger, as Steve's explained. What came out of the conference in terms of how the global pilot sector intends to oppose this push? And I guess, what is APA planning to do at a national level to oppose this? And then lastly, how will the members will be able to contribute to this effort?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. Let's start with that last part first off. I think one of the things here is that this needs to be driven by all of us. This is not just going to be APA, it's not just going to be AFAP, it's not just going to be AusAlpa. It needs to be driven by every pilot out there. We're the ones that know the job really well. We're the ones that know the risks of reducing crew on the flight deck. And we're the ones that are going to have to go out and sell that message to the travelling public. So it's going to take a concerted effort by all of us. Now, some of the things that have been done really well, I think, is this safetystartswith2.com website. And the two is not written as T-W-O, it's the number two. So safetystartswith2.com. Part of that is we need to be educating the public. And educating the public, I think, starts with educating our family and our friends, and then having them spread the message as well, and having the message kind of snowball out there to the public to raise awareness. I think we've already seen with our efforts probably over the last 6 months or so, and I think off the back of one of your op-eds in January, Hoff, we saw that, you know, 97% of the travelling public are dead set against this. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to kind of continuing to remind the public the value that the two well-trained, well-rested pilots bring to the operation. I think that's a really important part of it. But we're probably looking at ramping this up really with the membership within a few weeks' time. And again, this is not an issue that's going to be done and dusted. This is an issue that we are going to have to keep pushing on for the next couple of years. This is something that's not going to be post a link once, change of banner photo, and happy days, we're done. It's going to need effort by all of us over a fair amount of time in order to progress.
I'm assuming as well, you know, one of the, aspects of APA that a lot of people don't see is the regulatory affairs perspective of the association, in terms of also talking to people in Canberra, talking to CASA. My understanding is CASA at the moment haven't signalled their support to it. They're sort of sitting on the sidelines. So I guess that's the other places that we're going to be looking at, trying to, get the message through that we're not supportive and that the public aren't supportive of it.
Yeah, very much so, Hoff. I think that's a critical part of it as well. So I probably focus a bit much on what the membership can do before, but you're absolutely right. We'll be looking at engaging with the government and the opposition. We'll be looking at engaging with the regulator. As you say, the regulator so far has been that they've got a watching brief on what's happening overseas. The feedback from Boeing is the FAA in the US is not particularly keen on going too far down this road at the moment. I think that will probably change if EASA is going a bit harder at this. I think the US airlines will start pushing the FAA, particularly if they think there's a competitive advantage that some European airlines might get with RCO. Then the FAAA might start getting pressure from the US airlines as well. But ultimately for us, yeah, there's an element here of engaging with the government and the regulator to make sure that's being looked at. I was actually at a function with RMIT back in February, and the ATSB Chief Commissioner was there. He had some interesting things to say about when introducing changes like this, about making sure that the system understands the implications of what's achieving. So it's not just the technological battle. They might solve the technological battle of, the automation can solve the problem. But what they won't necessarily foresee is the issues that come up with training pilots to be able to operate that automation. That how do you pass on the experience for someone to be able to sit on the flight deck on their own, unless they're actually sitting there with another pilot for a few thousand hours, to learn the idiosyncrasies of that automation, to learn how that automation can bite them on the backside. We've all seen examples where we've come up towards weather and we can see it out the window, but the weather radar doesn't see it. And we're already avoiding it long before the weather radar has even detected that it's there, but that comes from training and experience. That comes from sitting beside other people and sharing experiences over long periods of time. And so I don't know that Airbus is actually looking at that type of issue.
No, I agree. I think it's Airbus are looking at it purely from the technological issue. And as you and I with the media stuff have just been pushing all the time, that there are so many other flow-on effects, even the mental health of pilots sitting by themselves for hours at a time. So I think, we're already doing good work in that space. We've got to keep doing it. The membership will play a part in that as well. But I think it sounds like, having spoken to you guys offline, that the work we've already been doing in this, we are at least in line or slightly ahead of the game compared to some other parts of the world. So we'll just keep working on that, and we look forward to our members, supporting us in that process. Thanks, Tony. Now, Shane, I understand FRMS remains a significant global challenge for all pilot unions. Where did the discussion on this issue focus? And again, I guess the question is, how does it impact our members, and what can they do to assist us with this challenge?
Yeah, good question, Mark. But before I go there, I'd just like to add a little something to what Tony and Steve have said with RCO. Just because we can do something doesn't mean we should, but we need to look at why this is being done. It probably wouldn't shock anybody if the conclusion was about cost saving. But we then look to what reasoning is given by people for the need. And one of those things you will hear is that the instance of pilot error necessitates removing the human from the machine. The problem with that is tied to the old adage of there's lies, damned lies, and statistics. And statistically, pilot error is the major single occurrence in accidents and incidents. But that's the case, because pilots are the ones driving the airplane. There is frequently something the pilot, through a superhuman effort, may have done to have got a different outcome. But pilots will always actually part of that equation, whether there is anything they can do about it or not. So the statistic that says that pilot error is the single largest contributor to accidents and incidents, and therefore a reason for automating the system, is fallacious and needs to be studied. So going on to your question about FRMS. So yes, FRMS did get some discussions at this meeting, not so much in the formal meeting part. It has been talked about formally many times in the past, and I've had many opportunities over the years to talk to pilots in other parts of the world and their FRMS experience. Why we keep talking about it was that fatigue risk management systems is a wonderful concept. We had to get away from prescriptive rules, and the way it was conducted in the early stages, very much a tripartite approach, that being ICAO, IATA, and IFALPA for the pilots. Those three bodies worked together to come up with guidance for operators and for airlines as to how we might conduct FRMS. That was about the last time there was proper tripartite arrangements. Ever since, the pilots have been largely left out of the equation other than in FSACs, fatigue safety action groups. And in some parts of the world, in some airlines, that body may not even exist or has little part to play. So because of this level of frustration in Australia, but knowing it is also the case around the globe, we at APA pushed for an informal meeting with members of the ICAO Fatigue Management Working Group. In that meeting, we pressed the argument that FRMS is not working as it should be. And the main reason for that is that pilots, their representatives, the people who live the experience, are not being heard. So we need to get back to the original tripartite attempt, getting those three parties in the room, and pilots' voices need to be heard. So that was heard pretty clearly at the ICAO informal meetings. We hope to see some movement in the not too distant future, and hopefully that'll give us an extra lever to point out to CASA, to our government, that just because something was planned with the good intent doesn't mean it will work that way in practice. And in Australia, it is not working in practice. We hope we'll get some changes there. So one of the things I hope that will come out of that is changes to those manuals. There are manuals out there. Many pilots are familiar with them. That's guidance to regulators, guidance to operators. That needs to be changed. We have to escalate the importance of pilot involvement. And I don't just mean pilots reporting. I don't just mean pilots on the FSAG who may or may not really have their voices heard, but an opportunity for pilot representatives to speak to the regulator to ensure that they understand all of the issues. And as we said, the effect of fatigue on a pilot is only truly known by those pilots who have to live it. So we'll see where that goes. I'm mildly hopeful. We did have the opportunity to meet with Australia's representative at ICAO. That was a spur of the moment opportunity. We were lucky to be afforded some time to speak to them. And that gave us an opportunity as well to point out to our representative there the importance of fatigue, why it's not working quite the way we'd hoped. And we also took the opportunity to talk more about those reduced crew operations. But can I reiterate once again that APA can do all its best work, but the members, the pilots, have got to do their bit. And that's given us the ammunition to help fight our wars. And that really is about reporting. So we're going to start a new operation, like Auckland to JFK. It's really, really important that pilots report their experiences. If they're good, they're terrific. But if they're not good, it's critically important we get that information. But the same applies for older operations. Just because we've been doing it for a long time doesn't mean we can't do it better, doesn't mean we can't make it safer. So ultimately, it's up to the pilots to give us that ammunition.
Well, thanks for that insight, Shane. Now, Steve, closer to home, I understand CASA has just announced that it's agreed to not increase the tailwind limit in Brisbane, which was proposed from going from 5 knots to 7 knots. This seems like a win, and I understand APA played a significant part in opposing this plan. Can you just give us a bit of information as to what's happening there?
Yeah, sure, Hoff. I think this is a really good example of the value that the safety and technical portfolio provides to our members. Certainly from my point of view, prior to coming into this role, in spite of the fact that I've been a member for some 18 years, I have very little idea of what S&T did. So a little bit of historical context. Obviously, Brisbane's second runway was constructed, became operational, I think, mid-2020. And that was during a time of of fairly low air traffic due to the ongoing effects of COVID. As that air traffic has increased, the residents around Brisbane Airport have, you know, been fairly active and vocal in complaining about the noise issues. And to mitigate against that, Air Services and Brisbane Airport sought to increase the current 5-knot tailwind limit. That's when we're considering which runway to be used, to increase that from 5 to 7 knots. My predecessor, who had carriage of this, and our staff and consultants made submissions to CASA on why this was a bad idea. And we recently received notification from CASA that they would not be approving this increase. So I think that's a real win for our pilots. Obviously, you know, sometimes these decisions get made by people who spend most, if not all, their time in an office and don't have to live with the impacts in an operational context. And S&T is there to fight against these kinds of changes and try to keep our work environment as safe as possible.
Well, thanks for that, and keep up the good fight. Tony, just to finish, is there anything you'd like to add summarising the IFALPA conference or anything maybe closer to home that you'd like to share with our members before we wrap up?
Yeah, there's a few things. I think one of the big themes that came out of the conference was this concept of being stronger together. And it was certainly reaffirmed to me by talking to some of the other member associations and some of the delegates that were there from other associations. I think one of the things that we are kind of blessed with in Australia is the fact that we actually have a reporting system or a regulatory system that is far less punitive than is overseas. You know, Shane was talking earlier about the importance of reporting fatigue. And you talk to some of the other member associations and their crew are reluctant to put in any report at all because of the adverse impacts that might come back to them from their airline or their regulator. And sometimes there's not much difference between the two of them. I mean, we frequently joke about CASA and Qantas. In other parts of the world, the relationship between the major airlines and the regulator are far closer than anything we see in Australia. So I think to understand our context and to understand the environment we're in and some of the benefits we have that we perhaps don't utilise as much as we should. You know, just to reiterate Shane's comments from before, the ability that we have to influence our own fatigue risk management system by reporting appropriately is a massive benefit that we've got that some of the other member associations around the world do not have. And so they're fighting to even get their pilots to report, let alone have a decent fatigue risk management system. I think a couple of things that that were quite good. Shane mentioned the fact that we managed to catch up with the Australian delegate to IACO and spend probably half an hour with him talking about some of the issues, providing him with some context around FRMS and some of the other challenges that we face in Australia. Certainly after the conference, I was able to spend probably about an hour and a half with the new IFALPA president, Captain Ben Mansa-Machai from Thai Pilot Association. And we were talking again about the importance of FRMS and the importance for ICAO to actually get in the game on the issue and start to put some, give some thought to what sort of boundaries they need to put around fatigue risk management systems and Kareem options for particularly ultra-long-haul operations as we're heading towards sunrise. But, yeah, this concept of stronger together. It was interesting talking to some of the American pilots about some of their work stuff. At the moment, United has got what they call informational pickets, which means they're not actually picketing or striking, but they are standing outside of airports holding up signs, competing for a better deal. Lots of us have heard about the increased contracts that are on offer in the USA. They've got very different rules. They're quite okay to go and stand outside an airport in uniform, holding up a sign for the travelling public, whereas our industrial landscape would have us in front of the Fair Work Commission for unprotected industrial action, were we to take similar action to what some of those US carriers are able to do. So it was interesting getting some idea from those other member associations about how they deal with, you know, their safety issues, how they deal with some of their industrial issues. And yeah, just kind of confirming the fact that we are stronger together. You know, IFALPA talks about being the global voice of pilots. And that concept of stronger together, I think was probably one of the key takeaways. And I think that applies even to APA, that we are stronger together when we talk with one voice. And it's quite funny, even as we're recording this podcast, my email's pinging off as the office staff are sending through all the emails that our members are writing to Canberra about the recruitment of foreign pilots for A220s and Dash 8 operations here in Australia. And I think that's a great example of where we are stronger together. But it's one thing for APA to write a letter, but it's that letter, when it's backed up by the active engagement of our membership, is what starts to make APA really strong. And it's what makes IFALPA really strong. So that's probably the couple of big themes and big kind of takeaways for me from the conference.
All right, thanks. I think it's, yeah, we're happy to lead, but we need people to follow. So the fact that people are starting that email chain and just starting to back their association is a good sign. So thank you to Tony, Shane and Steve for your insights on the IFALPA conference. It was an important chat to have because I think a lot of good work gets done there and you know, in some ways the more I think, now, APA is a bit of an iceberg in terms of what maybe sort of a lot of the members see compared to actually all the other stuff that goes on. So, you know, thank you very much for your insights, guys. Appreciate that. We'll be back with another podcast soon. We are now using a new studio, so hopefully the sound quality is a bit better for all of our listeners. But in the meantime, please fly safe and stick with it.